pretty full house we have here. That's cool. I hope I can make it worth your while to attend this presentation, which is Private Cloud Principles, Concepts, and Patterns. And I'm Tom Schinder. I'm a principal writer in the Server and Cloud Division Information Experience team. And my team is the Server and Cloud Division Solutions Group. And the solution that we're trying to solve for right now is how to help you architect, design, implement, and manage a private cloud. Some of you might recognize me in a past life. I was the isaserver.org guy, subsequently the TMG guy. I've written over 30 books on Windows, of which I think 12 of those were on isaserver and TMG. But times change, we need to change with the times, and now I'm in the clouds. Today's talk is going to be kind of high-level stuff. We're not going to get into bits and bytes. We're not going to pull any levers or push any buttons. What we want to start doing, because we're really in the infancy of cloud computing and private cloud, is to start thinking about how we're going to do things differently compared to the traditional data centers that we've worked in the past. So this talk is meant to be aspirational, something that you'll want to be able to do in the future, hopefully inspirational, so it'll be like, yeah, I want to do it in the future, and if nothing else, at least visionary and create some thought leadership, not among Microsoft, but among you as well as you start communicating cloud to your friends and colleagues. So our agenda today is we're going to talk about a few things. I'm going to start with architecture and the importance of architecture, IT architecture in particular, since we're going to be taking sort of an architectural approach in our discussion about private cloud today. Then I'm going to talk about some cloud service and deployment models. So we sort of start with a common vocabulary, a common understanding of what is cloud, what is maybe not cloud. Now, we may deviate from that common understanding as we move forward in the future, but let's start from a common place. Then we'll talk about the private cloud principles, concepts, and patterns, then the top 10 private cloud architectural issues, and then patterns in infrastructure as a service. So we're going to go from this day planner that you see here, which was our traditional data center, to using Outlook. So essentially, we will be rebooting our data center. And to reboot our data center, we need a strong architectural foundation. So first, why architecture? I'm going to do a little sales job with architecture, because before I was the infrastructure and operations guy. I was an ISIS server org guy. I was a Windows 2000 guy before that. And I really like to get deep in the weeds. I never really thought about architecture, this ITIL stuff. These other MOF and other architectural frameworks were like, yeah, those are for the gearheads, the star chart drawers, and didn't really have anything to do with me. But as we see with public cloud, private cloud, we're going to start doing things significantly different than how we used to do them. And so if we don't start with strong architectural foundational principles, we may end up making the same mistakes we did in the past. Of course, I wanted to know what's in it for me, and you probably want to know what's in it for you in terms of architecture and thinking about private cloud architecture. Well, here we have a study from the Corporate Executive Board where a bunch of CIOs were asked, which categories of staff skills do you see as, one, growing in importance, and two, having difficulty hiring or developing over the next 3 years? Well, 63% of those CIOs said they had they considered architecture, especially when it comes to cloud computing, as being of high importance. And almost half of them, 47%, said they were having difficulty finding cloud architects. Now, another study here is from Gartner. And this report says that there's going to be increasing emphasis on architecture roles as we move into the cloud future, private cloud, public cloud, hybrid cloud, community cloud. And that the job description of cloud architect is taking increasing importance and frequency in terms of job offerings seen in the next 5 to 10 years. And this is important. It's important to me, and I think it should be important to you, because I've read other studies that that say there may be up to a 75% contracture in the IT labor force in terms of infrastructure and operations, racking and stacking, server management, and similar duties that we're all used to doing within the next 5 to 10 years. Now, the discussion then moves forward to, well, are those people just going to go away, or are they going to move to new roles? And I believe, and many others believe, they'll move into new roles of cloud architects that start affiliating themselves with business groups so that IT moves from a cost center to a profit enabler for their organizations. The need for architecture. Does anybody in the room recognize this place, this house? What is it? Winchester Mansion, the Winchester Mystery House. So why is it a mystery? Well, it's been under construction for 38 years. It has 147 builders and zero architects. So if you have zero architects, what happens? You have 160 rooms, 40 bedrooms, 6 kitchens, 2 basements, 950 doors. 64 of those doors go to blank walls. 13 staircases have been abandoned, and there are 24 skylights in the floor, so you're not seeing too much sky there. Okay. No blueprint, no architectural blueprint exists for this house today. So does this remind you of any networks you might have seen? Right? Okay. It's because, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that, too. You know, we were growing from sort of sneakernet to netware to NT to the internet, and things were changing rapidly over the last 20 years. And so our networks weren't necessarily, we may have started with an architectural blueprint, but we deviated it because the change was happening so quickly that we abandoned our architectural blueprint, our framework. The nice thing about private cloud is it gives us a chance to reboot our data center, essentially to give us a mulligan. We're going to start over. We're going to use the private cloud to start over. We're going to architect that private cloud to be something that we're proud of and that we want to see in the future. Now, it's just not building architecture that's important. Do you think a surgeon or a neurologist will go in and do a procedure and just kind of draw an X over the back of the head and start drilling? No, they've got a lot of architectural background in anatomy and physiology and biochemistry, neuroscience, pathology, microbiology. All this background knowledge allows them to set the definitions important for the procedure or operation, the constraints, the things they can and can't do during that procedure, requirements for that procedure to be a success, and what to do at certain key decision points. Now, you might say, hey, Schindler, what do you know about that? Well, in a past life, I was a neurologist myself before I switched into IT. So for the rest of this talk, I just want to say, trust me, I'm a doctor. All right, so let's talk about the cloud service and deployment models. This is going to help us understand and have a common point of departure and a set of definitions that maybe we can agree on. We may move past these in the future, but let's start with at least a foundational agreement. So this is the NIST, the United States National Institute of Standards and Technology definition of cloud computing. And according to NIST, there are 5 essential characteristics. On-demand self-service, which means consumers of the cloud service can obtain resources from the cloud on demand with minimal human intervention. Broad network access, meaning that people can access the cloud resources from virtually any device, from virtually any location in the world. Resource pooling, compute, network, and storage subsist or exist in a pool that's shared among all the consumers of the cloud service. Rapid elasticity allows consumers of the cloud service to quickly get resources they need, but then release them back into the shared pool when they're no longer required. And measured services, or chargeback, or pay-as-you-go. The consumer of the cloud service should be aware of how much it costs to obtain cloud resources, compute, storage, and networking, so that they pay for only what they use. Now, there are 3 service models in cloud computing, according to NIST. 3 service models. Infrastructure as a service, where you, as a cloud service provider, provide core infrastructure to the consumers of the cloud. Core infrastructure being compute, storage, and networking. Platform as a service is where you, as a cloud service provider in a private cloud, may provide the development platform and allow people to develop their applications and deploy them in your cloud infrastructure. And then software as a service or finished services are provided by you as a cloud service provider so that consumers of cloud service say, I want to use SharePoint or Outlook or whatever, and they click a button and they have access and provision users and so forth. So those are the three service models. There are four deployment models defined by NIST. Private cloud just means, it doesn't mean anything else, it means that the cloud infrastructure belongs to your organization and nobody else's. Forget all the rest, okay? People get very confused when I talk about private cloud. Private cloud's infrastructure as a service. No, private cloud is like a data center that's hosted or on, or whatever. I've heard 100 different definitions. Private cloud is a cloud infrastructure that belongs to a single organization. Community cloud is a cloud infrastructure that is shared among multiple related organizations, such as maybe multiple local governments. Public cloud is a cloud infrastructure that's shared by unrelated organizations, many of which may be competitors with one another, and they're sharing these pooled resources. And then hybrid clouds is any combination of the above, but is usually associated with the combination of private and public cloud. Now, our focus today is going to be on private cloud. Now, there's a bunch of common characteristics that you see in cloud computing, and depending on your cloud, deployment may or may not be there. Things such as massive scale and homogeneity. Virtualization is seen virtually everywhere, although not required. If you have some other compute-dense architecture, you can deploy a cloud without virtualization, but it would be much more complex and would cost a heck of a lot more. Low-cost software, resilient computing, geodistribution, service orientation, advanced security, all are some of these you may see in a cloud environment. So this is going to be our common understanding. These are our common definitions. Now, we may depart from them, especially with private cloud, because some people will say that broad network access doesn't necessarily fit with the private cloud. I mean, people deploy private clouds to keep people away from that regulated information. But in other private clouds, you may want people to have broad network access to that information. Now, our focus today is primarily on infrastructure as a service, because I think this is where most organizations are going to start. And then after we've mastered infrastructure as a service, then we'll start thinking about providing a platform as a service in a private cloud, and finally SaaS. Again, there is no vertical alignment between these service models and deployment models. Cloud is cloud. Cloud is cloud and must have the essential characteristics. Okay? Private cloud just means one organization. Public cloud means multiple unrelated organizations, but a cloud is still cloud, whether it's public or private. Let's talk about the private cloud principles, concepts, and patterns. These principles, concepts, and patterns were developed by our services group and the Brain Trust and the product groups and a lot of people within Microsoft and outside of Microsoft. And these are meant for you to think about as you're architecting your private cloud environment. You're going to see a lot of stuff in the next few days on System Center and Windows Server 2012 and the capabilities and the things that enable you to do. But you want to, when you're designing that private cloud, to think about these principles, concepts, and patterns. So first, what are principles? Principles provide general rules and guidelines that support the evolution of a cloud infrastructure. They are enduring, so they're not going to change every week. Seldom amended, so we're not going to monkey around with them, you know, willy-nilly, and inform and support a way the cloud fulfills its mission. They strive to be compelling, like, yeah, I'd like those principles, and aspirational, meaning, yeah, I really want to achieve these principles in my private cloud. These principles form the basis on which a cloud infrastructure is planned, designed, and created. So now I present to you the 10 private cloud principles. Okay, enough of that. Okay, so what are the 10 private cloud principles? Business value through continuous improvement, okay? We'll see as in the private cloud, We'll talk about how we're moving from keeping the lights on to being service providers, so we always want to be able to improve the services we provide the consumers of our cloud. The perception of infinite capacity. We want to be able to provide the consumers of our cloud services a perception that there are no limitations to capacity that they can acquire from our private cloud. The perception of continuous availability. We want to create the perception among the consumers of the private cloud infrastructure that we're going to provide, the perception that it's continuously available. Now, it may not always be available, but we want to create that perception. We want to take a service provider's approach, meaning we don't want to keep the lights on anymore. We want to make sure the services are running, even if some of the lights are out. Optimize resource utilization. We want to make sure that we optimize the use of compute, networking, and storage so that nothing's wasted, that we have enough to provide enough to meet our service level agreements with the consumers of the cloud service and be able to grow in a predictable fashion, which we'll talk about later. We want to take a holistic approach to availability, which means we just don't want to use hardware redundancy. It costs too much money. It's so 1990s, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Ubiquitous automation. The key ROI story for cloud computing is automation. We want to drive predictability. Predictability means that we will be able to support the mobile workloads. The VMs will be able to move from server to server to server within our cloud infrastructure, and we will be able to predict the level of performance that they will be able to provide the consumers. Incentivize desired behavior. We want to make it easy for the consumers of the cloud services to do the right thing and not abuse the cloud infrastructure. And then create a seamless user experience. We don't want users to have to worry about going through multiple consoles and multiple services to get what they need. There are also 14 private cloud concepts that support the principles. So what are concepts? Well, our concepts are abstractions or strategies that support the principles. And they facilitate the composition of the cloud. They're guided by and directly support one or more of the principles. So now I present to you the 14 private cloud principles. Predictability. We don't want any surprises in the private cloud. Resources have to move from machine to machine to machine. Workloads have to move around. And we want to make sure that they behave the same no matter where they're located in the cloud. Resiliency over redundancy. We want to take advantage of advancements in software and decouple services from the hardware infrastructure so that we use software capabilities to save money by not having to do redundancy. Homogenized hardware. This enables predictability because we're using the same hardware throughout our cloud infrastructure. Pool compute resources. All consumers of the cloud service will be obtaining resources from a pool, storage, networking, and compute. Virtualized infrastructure. We use virtualization because it's cost-effective and easy to manage. Fabric management is sort of that magic that you'll see in VMM and all the system center products that enable us to have the automation and the predictability that's required in a well-architected private cloud. Elastic infrastructure, the ability to grow up and then release resources back into the cloud. Partition shared resources so that consumers are strictly partitioned. This is very important from a security point of view. We'll talk about that in our talk on private cloud security architecture. Resource decay, we'll talk about, is one of our patterns that we have to deal with in the private cloud, where we expect servers to die, and we design the private cloud infrastructure with that in mind. Service classification, we want to be able to provide a menu to the consumer of the cloud services so that they could have t-shirt sizes, right? Small, medium, and large, so we define service classes. Cost transparency, this speaks to the metered services. Consumption-based pricing, again, metered services. Security and identity doesn't change, but gets more interesting in the private cloud, and we'll talk about that in the private cloud security talk tomorrow. And multi-tenancy. We also have 9 private cloud patterns. Patterns are essentially best practices. They are specific, reusable ideas that have been proven solutions, which means that we've actually deployed these with customers, Microsoft Consulting Services, to commonly occurring problems, and that patterns are useful for enabling the cloud computing concepts and principles. These are the cloud computing patterns. I'm going to go into these in more detail later, so I won't go through an explanation right now. But they are resource pooling, physical fault domain, upgrade domain, reserve capacity, scale unit, capacity plan, health model, service class, and cost model. All right. Now let's take a look at some of the top 10 private cloud architectural issues that we've run into in the field. These are things that have represented real challenges and new insights to us as we move from traditional data center computing to private cloud. First, private cloud, like I said, is our opportunity to reboot the data center. It's also giving us an opportunity to think about how to do things differently. Essentially, it's a new world order. However, when we're dealing with a new world order, we're going to have to deal with some pushback. Okay? I was reading some organizational principles the other day, and there's 15% of the people that are cavemen, okay? Cave, C-A-V-E. They're the committee against virtually everything, okay? Those are the cavemen. Then there's 70% of people who are sitting back and watching, and then there's 15% of the people who are the visionaries. And so you as the cloud architects here are going to be the visionaries for your private cloud computing infrastructure. But you're going to run against folks like this guy who says, well, it's the best practice. Or this guy, Gartner, says it's the way. This is the way to do it. Well, Gartner's got their opinion, but they may be stuck in old ways of thinking, so we have to take that into consideration. Then we have, well, that's how we've always done it. Well, that's how you always did it in a traditional data center, but things are changing in a private cloud. And then we've got, the auditors said to do it this way. That's my favorite, the auditors, right? I mean, they're always behind anyhow. Now we're going to have to introduce them to this cloud stuff. For example, anybody know what this is? Anybody want to take a guess? Air exchanger, right? Passive flow air exchanger, right. This is how we cool our data center, right? We don't use air conditioning and HVAC, anything like that. We all use passive flow, right? No. But we've discovered that, given the right environmental attributes, the cloud architects on our team found that this worked great, and that the failure that we had, remember we talked about resource decay as one of the private cloud concepts, our resource decay was not significantly affected if we spent tens of thousands of dollars a year on electricity versus passive airflow. So, not necessarily a best practice, but as we started thinking about new ways of doing things, this may become a best practice in the future. Another thing we discovered is, guess what? You're a service provider. Okay. The way I used to do things was I wanted to make sure the servers were running and the switches were on and that I got good ping times, right? Well, things are changing now with the private cloud because we've got competition, and that competition is with the public cloud providers. Okay. Our internal IT groups now will have to have an increase in our service management maturity so that we can provide the same cost information to our leadership team that the public cloud providers can provide. And if we can't do that, our leadership may say, well, I'll just go to the public cloud then because they're going to give me all these numbers. So our approach to service management needs to change, and this focuses the principle number four. Another thing we found is, well, virtualization is an enabler. It's not necessarily a cloud solution. I mean, virtualization is the best thing since sliced bread, right? I mean, we all love it. You know, don't know how we lived without it. But we actually found with virtualization, especially large virtualization products, that we actually had a reduction in our quality of service. Now, there were a number of reasons for this. First is they introduced greater complexity. I mean, virtualization was supposed to solve the problem of server sprawl, but what did it give us? VM sprawl. right? Now where we had hundreds of servers to deal with, now we have thousands of VMs to deal with. It increased the complexity and ended up making a lot of the companies involved more reactive. Part of the problem causing this increase in reactivity rather than proactivity was that we didn't have the right monitoring tools. As all these VMs spun up, these thousands of VMs spun up and wouldn't be elastic, so they didn't spin down. We ended up with problems with the mean time to restore services going up. So remember, virtualized data centers are great, but they're part of the path to the private cloud. They are not a private cloud. They don't all meet the five essential characteristics of cloud computing, and they don't all map to the principles, concepts, and patterns of private cloud. We found that homogeneity drove multiple efficiencies, and that simplicity is indeed elegance. And when I say homogeneity, I mean that you're running the same server hardware, the same networking hardware, the same storage hardware throughout your private cloud. You're not mixing and matching like, oh, we need another server today. Let's get a few from Dell or HP or whoever and throw it in the data center. We want to be very planful about our hardware and have homogeneous hardware as much as possible. Why? Because it drives predictable performance, it reduces our cost of acquisition, and helps us with our lead time, helps us with predicting time for new acquisitions. And homogeneity maps to concept number three in our private cloud principles, concepts, and patterns. Now, simplicity is elegance, but as a smart guy once said, everything should be as made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Okay? Still going to be difficult, but homogeneity as much as possible, because we know that server SKUs evolve over time, right? I'm going to try to make it as simple as possible. Redundancy. Redundancy is so 1990s. Why do I say 1990s? Because that was sort of the birth of client-server computing, where we had stateful applications. And what was significant about these stateful applications? It was there was a tight mapping, an iron fist wrapped around the application and binding it to the hardware infrastructure that supported it. Made them sessile, made them immobile applications. The arch enemy of a private cloud infrastructure. Private cloud, we want to move our workloads from machine to machine to machine within the data center to maybe a hosted cloud provider, to maybe Azure or some other infrastructure as a service provider. And so we have to move away from redundancy because of the price and the fact that we think about redundancy because of our legacy and traditional client server. And redundancy is also very expensive, too. I mean, we've got capital expenditures for all this redundant hardware. We have operational expenses we have to deal with in power and maintenance. And it's all driven by stateful applications. Okay? So we want to replace redundancy with resiliency. Is redundancy worth the cost? I mean, everybody loves five nines, right? Five nines, always uptime. And we, private cloud principle is perception of continuous availability. So redundancy must be important, right? Got to be consistent. So let's take a look at different forms of redundancy here. First, we've got the economy class here. Our economy class is no UPS and no generator. We've got straight utility power, and it gave us three nines availability. This is from studies that we've done in our cloud engagements. The probability of failure in 5 years was 100%. So, I mean, it's economy class. You get what you pay for, right? And it doesn't cost that much. Business class is a little better, right? We've got a UPS, and then we've got two choices in terms of generator. With no generator, we have availability of three nines, probability of failure in 5 years of 87%. With the generator, availability of three nines, and a probability of failure in 5 years of 50%. So, it's better, but, you know, it costs a bit more. Now what we could do is we could take a look at our Gulfstream class availability and redundancy. That's N plus one UPSs, N plus one generator, six nines availability, six nines, and a probability of failure in 5 years of less than 1%. pretty good, but cha-ching, it's going to cost a heck of a lot. So when we get into our discussions with the consumers of our cloud service, we need to think about, let me go back there, we need to think about having discussions with them saying, okay, if there's a failure, how much does it cost you per unit time? And they provide you those numbers, and then you say, okay, this is how much it's going to cost you. Is it going to cost you more to consume our private cloud resources by having the Gulfstream class than it's going to cost you in terms of how much you leave, how much you lose during your downtime? Those are the kind of discussions you want to get into with the business groups who are going to be consuming your cloud services. We also want to take into consideration that we may fail more often in a private cloud environment, but the point is to recover fast, because we're taking a service provider's approach. We're not just about keeping the lights on, we're keeping the services running. This is how we provide value. This is how we show that the work that we're doing is increasing the bottom line for the organization and keeping them more agile and more effective. So here we see a chart of mean time between failure and mean time to restore services for traditional data center and private cloud. So here we see the mean time between failure for a traditional data center, 2 units on this chart, and the mean time to restore services, which is 3 units on this chart. These are for the traditional data center. Now, for the private cloud, we have a mean time between failure of only 1 unit, so we're failing a lot more quickly in the private cloud. But we also have a very short time to restore services, too. So what we can do is, in the private cloud, we can use software-enabled resiliency, which plans for failure states and focuses on fast service restoration. So we have more failures, but less total service downtime. And we can see that in this picture here, where if we squeeze the total, all the mean time to restore services together for the for the private cloud or dynamic data center, and compare that to the mean time to restore services for a single failure cycle, we can see that we're up a lot more, even though we fail more often. And it's uptime that we care about as a service provider. We don't care if the servers die. We don't care if the network dies. We don't care if the storage dies. We want to get the services back. So it's the fabric management that enables this resiliency. So traditionally, we were interested in avoiding hardware failures. We wanted to be redundant at all levels. We had a longer time between failure, but we had more disruption with each failure. And our service uptime could be around 5 nines with redundancy-driven high availability. With resiliency-based high availability, our goal is to minimize service disruption, automate fault detection and responses, fail often, and recover fast. And that's with resiliency software-driven high availability. Another thing we realized is we've got to make sure that our users don't abuse the cloud. So even though one of our private cloud principles is the perception of infinite capacity, we know we don't have infinite capacity. Sure, we like infinite capacity, but we don't. So we have to make our users good environmentalists. We have to make them good stewards of our private cloud infrastructure that they're consuming. So we want to let them know you only pay for what you use. You know? So figure out what you need and then get what you need, but don't get more unless you need it. Show them the cost of the 5 nines like we did earlier. Make sure that the cost of the 5 nines is not more than what it costs them if they have a service downtime. Make it easy for the users to take advantage of elasticity, not just up, because everybody loves elasticity upwards. Developers love to develop. If you tell them I can grow from 4 gigs to 8 gigs to 16 to 32 gigs of memory dynamically on the fly like that, as my service requires, they'll love that, right? Absolutely. But we also want to make it easy for them to release those resources when we create our service catalogs so that when they're done with it, they can create a policy, either date-based, or they can click a simple button, and bam, their resources go back into the shared pool. We also want to educate them on the cloud, how to create cloud-enabled applications that are stateless, that take advantage of cloud capabilities, to allow them to decouple those hard links between their software and the hardware infrastructure on which your software runs. We want to move from the 1990s world of stateful applications to the 21st century, the second decade in the 21st century of stateless applications, cloud-enabled applications. And this speaks to principle number 9, which is incentivize desired behavior. Now, health model was one of our principles, and a health model must provide visibility into the hardware infrastructure. And this goes to the fact that we're not very good with our hardware. Yuri Diogenes is in the room today. He was with CSS, with ISIS server and TMG, and invariably, when customers called with a problem, they always said it was TMG's fault because someone couldn't connect to the internet or couldn't connect to the network. Now, is that how we were told to troubleshoot problems? Where are we supposed to start at? Layer 7 or layer 1? 7? 1? Layer 1, right? We would troubleshoot at layer 1. Start at the bottom and work your way to the top. So we have to come with a health model to provide visibility into our hardware infrastructure, because we want to know if our hardware is sick, because we will want to be able to define the difference between a failure state and a disaster and degraded service and zero service. So there's more to services than just software. There's the hardware. We need to understand the hardware interactions and the dependencies between the software and the hardware. We need to know what a healthy looks like. And conversely, we need to know what unhealthy looks like so that we know what a failure looks like. That'll enable us to detect and respond depending on our understanding of the difference between failure and disaster. And this speaks to pattern number 7, which is the health model. So is it a headache or a hemorrhage? We need to define both failure. And what is the difference between failure and a disaster? So how do failures in compute, storage, and networking affect the service as a whole, your entire infrastructure as a service solution? Don't know? We need to create a dependency tree then. How the pieces of the software that we're running our solution. So Windows Server 2012, System Center, VMware, whatever you're using, doesn't matter. This is architectural talk, so I'm not talking about products here. Likely you're going to use a wide variety of products, but the architectural principles, concepts, and patterns remain the same regardless of what vendor you choose. We need to determine when a failure becomes a disaster, because this will enable us to detect and automate both failure and disaster responses. And that detection and that automation are key. Automation drives the cloud. Like I said earlier, the key value proposition, the key ROI story you have for cloud is automation. And automation also feeds into that perception of continuous availability and your overall level of service performance. Okay? So domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. Thank you very much, Mr. Robot. So automation is different than manual approaches, right? Manual is Bob here gets a page at 2 in the morning, kind of drags himself out to bed. Someone says there's something wrong, go fix it, and he goes to the data center, RDPs in, and hopes for the best. Okay, it's slow and error-prone, so we're moving definitely away from that. Then there are also mechanized approaches that a lot of us use. Mechanized approaches are Bob gets the call, says there's something wrong. He checks the run book and says, oh, okay, this seems to be the problem, and then runs a couple of scripts. Okay, that's mechanized. It's a little faster. It's a little bit more predictable. But private cloud is all about automation, as Mr. Data here would say, because automation is fast and predictable. Okay. So we take our scripts, we take our run books, we put them through the programmatic process, we test them. We test them again, we test them again to make sure they don't introduce errors, because a single error could take down your entire private cloud infrastructure, and it could be cataclysmic because all the services can go down. Now we'll take a look at some infrastructure as a service patterns. patterns or best practices and things that we've identified as really helping you get the most out of a private cloud infrastructure. First, we'll do a little overview of what these patterns are. We have a resource pool. We've got a scale unit. We've got a fault domain. We've got an upgrade domain. And we have the concept of resource decay. Now let's look at these in a little more detail. So a resource pool is just that. Whoops. It's just a pool of compute, storage, and networking resources that is divvied up among the consumers of the cloud service. Okay. This is an example of a server resource pool, but you could also have a storage resource pool too. That's principle number four. Pattern number five is a scale unit. So here we have the resource pool, but how do we add to the resource pool when we run out of resources? Because we have to be consistent with the principles. One of the principles is a perception of infinite capacity. So we have to be able to add to the resource pool in a logical and predictable manner. Predictability is another one of the principles. And so what we do is we create this concept of a scale unit that allows us to add resources as standardized increments to the private cloud. These standardized increments take advantage of the principle of homogeneity. Okay, homogeneity. So this then provides us known environmental requirements. We know what the cooling requirements are going to be for a scale unit. We know what the standardized engineering processes are going to be in terms of racking and stacking and cabling, so that as we need more capacity, we know, okay, we're going to get ourselves a scale unit. We know what the lead time is too, because we've already worked out agreements with our vendors, and we've looked at resource usage patterns over time. We see, okay, at this certain time, we looked at our growth pattern, bam, time to get a new scale unit, and then we watch again and watch again and said, okay, time to get another scale unit, bam. So this is how we add capacity. Now, as I mentioned, we could have compute scale units like what I show here. We could also create storage scale units, pattern number five. Now we have this concept of resource decay. As I mentioned, we don't really care if stuff fails. We expect stuff to fail. We don't want to spend a lot of money on redundancy. So what we do is we realize the resources within the resource pool are going to decay at a certain rate over time. What this allows us to do is it allows us to move away from a break-fix model. Okay? What we do instead is we use a pool-based model, and we define the percentage of resources within the pool that are allowed to decay before we service them. That way we're not running back and forth, oh, the server's down, oh, I've got to pull it out and put another one in. Right? Much more planful. We expect things to fail. We can recover quickly. And because we're taking advantage of the mobility characteristics within the cloud, when a resource fails, the workloads just move to another host within the cloud infrastructure. Now we have the fault domain, the concept of a fault domain. This is where we take a look at failure of multiple machines due to a non-server component failure. Okay? What you want to do is you want to think about what component is most likely to fail in the data center other than the server. And we found that probably the UPS is the most common. So here's an example of a fault domain where all the servers in this rack has failed because the UPS has failed. Okay? And you think about how many servers are impacted when you have a failure in the fault domain. Okay? In this case, we call this a physical fault domain. We also have this concept of upgrade domain, pattern number three, upgrade domain. Even though we have a highly virtualized infrastructure, we still need to upgrade the host servers. When we upgrade the host servers, we're going to have to take them offline. When we take them offline, they're not going to be available to service workloads because we're going to have to move the workloads off these servers. So we have this concept of upgrade domain where all the host servers that we define in our upgrade domain are upgraded, they're maintained simultaneously, and the workloads are migrated away during the upgrade process for those in the upgrade domain. and then they'll move back as we do rolling upgrades throughout the cloud infrastructure. Now, let's bring all these three concepts together into what we might call a worst-case scenario. So first, we've reached our maximum number of machines that have decayed. Okay? Oh, and while we reached that D max, we just had a failure of one of our fault domains. And then, oh, darn, we were also doing an upgrade, a rolling upgrade, too. So in this scenario, 3% of our server capacity is in decay, 2% is in upgrade, and 10% is lost by loss in a single fault domain. So 15% of our total capacity is lost. Now, we need to think about that. If we have 15% of our total capacity lost, what are we going to need to make sure that we don't have a degradation of service during this kind of situation? Well, that introduces us to the pattern of reserve capacity. And what reserve capacity is represents what we consider our worst-case scenario in terms of having degraded services, where we can move the workloads off of those into machines that are being held in reserve for that situation. Now, this might be our breakpoint for a disaster recovery situation. Okay? Takes advantage of homogeneity because the machines in the reserve capacity machines are the same as those that the workloads were running on before. So the VMs can be relocated predictably. We combine the concepts of the resource decay, fault, and upgrade domains. Our formula is a reserve capacity equals the percentage you assign to the fault domain, and that's up to you as the architect. The percentage that we allow to be in max decay, and then the percentage of machines that we define for our upgrade domain. And then divide that by the number of machines that we will have in reserve for our reserve capacity. So unlike some speakers, I like to finish early. But I would like to ask you a question as I finish. What do you think about our private cloud infrastructure, architecture, I mean? Do you want to run and hide from it? Do you think it's kind of scary? Do you feel a need to protect yourself from it? Or, like me, do you love it? All right. Obviously, I went through a whole ton of ideas and a whole ton of concepts, and the principles, concepts, and patterns go very deep. And you'll want to really get a firm understanding of all these things before you start actually deploying your private cloud infrastructures. So we have a very nice paper that was put together by Bill Leffler on my team. Bill's in the room, but I'm not going to point him out to you because he's a very humble kind of guy. It's a fantastic paper, one of the best written conceptual papers I've ever read. Usually, I'm a button pusher and I like to do things, but this was actually very interesting and you'll want to read it from beginning to end. There's the aka.ms link there, aka.ms/ZRIQM3, if you want to check that out. Also, we have a free book for you that was written by the Windows Server team together with Mitch Tulloch, and it's called Introducing Windows Server 2012. Read the whole book, but pay special attention to Chapter 2, which is about private cloud. And Yuri Diogenes and I, as well as other people in the Windows Server group, have written big chunks of this. A lot of people from our services group, too, with real-life experience on how to build private clouds with Windows Server 2012 that resonate with the private cloud principles, concepts, and patterns. Also, there's no promotion like self-promotion. So I want to tell you that there's going to be a new Windows Server 2012 security book entitled Windows Server 2012 Security from End to Edge and Beyond, written by me and Yuri Diogenes. Yuri, raise your hand. Yeah. Expected to be released by the first quarter of 2013. It's going to be a great book. We're going to cover all the new security technologies, how to architect, design, deploy, and manage these security technologies in Windows Server 2012. So I'm not straying completely off the the security track here. Got to keep a foot in there. For related content, we have a lot of good sessions here: Architecting Private Clouds of Windows Server 2012, Intro to Microsoft Private Cloud, Private Cloud Fast Track, Private Cloud Security Architecture, a solution for private cloud security that I'll be doing together with Yuri Diogenes tomorrow. Hybrid computing is the new net norm. We also have Deploying Private Cloud, Lessons Learned from the Windows Server 2012 TAP, and Understanding and Deploying Hosted Private Cloud that I'll be doing together with Yuri Diogenes and Josh Adams on Wednesday. More resources: My Tech Ed, Microsoft Learning, Microsoft TechNet, and MSDN. You've probably seen these in the other talks. Make sure to visit them early and visit them often. Complete the evaluation and win an Xbox. We're giving away an Xbox One every day. The more you evaluate, you can evaluate me multiple times so you can figure out how to do it. Better chance to win the Xbox. Or you can get one of those crazy geek robots, USB things, or a gift card from Best Buy. That's hard to beat. And then scan the tag and evaluate the session on TechEd Mobile. So, with 23 minutes to spare, you can leave or ask questions. Thank you.